Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hello, I have some very exciting news for you, provided your definition of exciting news is sitting in a theatre and listening to me speak while you slowly get drunker and drunker. The first major Sentimental Garbage live show is happening this January 20th at the Bloomsbury Theatre in King's Cross, London. It is the biggest ever Sentimental Garbage live event. I'm really excited. The theatre is huge, but having said that, they tell me the tickets are likely to sell out very quickly. So while general tickets are on sale from Friday the 9th of December, which is tomorrow if you're listening to this podcast on the day it comes out, you can access priority tickets right now if you go to sentimentalgarbage.substack.com and sign up. I am so excited for this show. The live events are always such a good time. And because it's like my first big event like this, it's going to be very, very exciting because we may be planning a little after party for afterwards where we can all take up the pent up sentimental garbage energy and go dancing afterwards. I don't have a link for that right now, but I will very soon. So keep your eyes peeled on the Instagram and on the email page. Look in the show notes for the relevant links, or for more, go to fame.co.uk/sentimentalgarbage. Otherwise, I hope to see you January 20th at the Bloomsbury Theatre. Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline O'Donoghue, and Argentina is good for two things, beef and Nazis. Joining me is the man who still hasn't recovered from his pencil accident. It's Sam Sedgman.
I object. Hello. Thank Hi. You so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. And thank you for finally coming on, actually, I should say, because we've been talking around this for a long time. Mm. And every time we do, you suggest something to do with Sandra Bullock. And so it's luck of the draw that we're finally on while you were sleeping.
Well, I could not be happier to talk about this deranged film that I love very dearly.
It's so lovely. And I can't believe I just watched it for the first time.
For the first time. How have you escaped it for this long?
I remember, I have such a fuzzy memory of it playing on a very small TV in a spare room somewhere kind of thing. And for some reason, I thought it was a thriller because...
There's another version of this movie that's a thriller.
His
family doesn't know.
His family, yeah. I remember all the hospital scenes. I remembered her, like, really tearful at his bedside.
You're so right.
But then, when I turned it on last night, when I heard, "This will be an everlasting love," I was like, oh, it's this.
Yeah, it's a very different mood. You could recut this movie to be a thriller. Like that Mary Poppins trailer, where they recut it to be like, she's in their house and the kids aren't safe. Yeah,
the kids aren't safe.
And I did read a recent review, like a reassessment of this movie by a journalist who was not impressed by it and said it's like an ode to gaslighting and
that is the most 2017 fucking shit I've ever heard.
It's like you need to not take this movie that seriously, but take it at the level that it's given you. But yeah, there is some weird things that only work as a friendly, uplifting movie in the 90s about this. And I think that's why I love it. It's very of its time.
And I think that was why I was confused about it, because I think it has now become such a meme because of all of the kind of the 90s rom-coms, some of which are classic, some of which are B-tier but still firmly loved, you know? This is always like the joke one in a way. Even though people love it and they find it cozy and stuff, they're like, what an insane premise.
That's the thing. It is insane. But as I rewatched it, it's insane in a way that I find immune to criticism. Like, you know, someone could be there pointing out how ridiculous this whole thing is and like you can throw a rock at it and it bounces right off. Yeah. You don't care.
You don't care.
And that's because there's so much incredible, often ignored, like craft to this movie and the way it was made. The performances, Sandra, who we'll get into, absolutely nuclear-powered charisma at the heart of this movie. But everyone in this movie, the way it's made, the story, the function of it, it works in a way that movies don't work like this anymore.
Yeah.
We've talked about that several times, but like it's a masterpiece of its own, on its own terms, I would say.
No, I really do agree. And I have a couple of like disagreements with it, mostly to do with the score.
Oh, sure.
More in that, I think that, and I'm just get out of the way up top, where it's really my only criticism of the entire movie, in that like it's so, it feels like in post they were like, we really have to make people know that this isn't creepy.
Yes.
And we're going to put in so much strings and things to tell you how to feel.
Yep.
That honestly, the dialogue is perfect, but if there was no dialogue, you'd know exactly what was happening based on just, now it's the meaningful music, and no, it's the whatever, you know, it's like.
Yeah, they kind of maybe bottled it at the last minute.
Yeah, it's like they kind of lost the faith in their own concept, and that's why the score bummed me out.
But it makes you wonder if they did rescore it to lean into the creep.
Yeah.
Whether the secret is the score. I don't know. But the score like does what it needs to do.
Yeah.
You know, like you're never in doubt about how you're supposed to feel.
Exactly.
And is that a problem in a rom-com? You know, I don't know that it is.
Yeah, like, no, it's not. And I think.
But it's very in your face. You're completely right.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very, you know, high in the mix, I guess. And the thing about rom-coms is the same thing with any kind of great genre movie, whether it's horror or spies or whatever, which is that the mad concepts and the overblownness of it all is there to present you a universal truth that can only be really investigated through an overblown metaphor. And I think the sort of truth underneath the craziness of the movie is how crushing it is to be alone.
Oh, like, yes. And I think that's why this movie sustains for me as something that I want to go back to again and again, is because you've got all the fluff and the structure and that they fall in love and that's very sweet, and all the jumpers, which we'll, I'm sure, get into in great detail. The jumpers, the jumper content of this movie is spectacular. But yeah, there's a very dark well of sadness at the heart of this movie that you don't often see in a romantic comedy. And it's played so well, and it really, that's kind of where all of the feelings come from, I think, in this movie. Like all the stuff with the dead dad and the...
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, we'll get into her wearing her dead dad's coat for the whole movie, I think.
Her dad's entire wardrobe, by the looks of it.
The whole wardrobe, you're quite right. But yeah, there's a real sadness at the heart of this movie that it speaks to. And it's the fact that it's set at Christmas time and it's about family and needing to have people around you. It's very... Yeah, it's really evocative and very strong in a way that I think a lot of other rom-coms aren't. And it would be easy to write a version of this that is creepy or is frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that it takes itself seriously enough and the characters seriously enough, even in the middle of this absurd premise, makes you feel things even when you know it's silly and ridiculous. And I think that's part of why it sticks around.
Yeah, I think when something has such a crazy concept...
Yeah.
The sort of emotional truth that underlines and underpins, it's like they need to... I remember we talked about this during the Sex and the City series, where when the real life stakes spike in Sex and the City, the crazy showbiz life, it's like, you know, Samantha doesn't have cancer, she has cancer in a premiere, you know?
Yeah.
And that makes it pleasurable and it makes life feel bearable. And that's what these kind of movies are about. It's about making life feel bearable.
Yeah.
And... and there's something, in You've Got Mail, it's like, yes, it's the story of these like two unlikely business owners who meet on AOL kind of thing. But underneath that is a story about a woman who misses her mother and is clinging on to her mother's life just to keep her alive and then is free of it, you know?
Absolutely. And I think there are some romantic comedies which we look back on and we think of now, I think, as... great movies, like pinnacles of culture. Mm-hmm. And like When Harry Met Sally, I think, is like the ultimate romantic comedy, certainly of the 90s. It's definitely the 90s, isn't it? It's not late 80s, is it?
It's 90s. It's 90s, firmly 90s,
While He Was Sleeping is not a great movie in like the canon of great movies, but it is a spectacular example of craft in this genre.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't like try to elevate itself into that like upper echelon of like, When Harry Met Sally, like, you know, got nominated for Oscars. Like this movie... Yeah. You could argue that Sandra Bullock deserves an Oscar for this performance because it's one of her greatest performances, I think, and the kind that is so often ignored. But she made this movie coming off the back of Speed, which is her breakthrough, and I think one of the greatest movies of all time.
It was her public transport era.
She was very much like the icon of mass transit with Sandy in the 90s. It's a real thing. But I think this is a really interesting movie to compare to Speed, because they're both like excellent examples of genre. But people look back at Speed now as a truly great movie, as like an example of action cinema for the ages. And no one really looks back at While You Were Sleeping and thinks it was all that good, like culturally.
That's because boys like Speed.
That's because boys like Speed. It's very true. But like people look at Speed and be like, oh, but the practical effects, like the scoring, you know, the way the script pops, like the chemistry that they have, the premise, the execution. Man, that's a great movie. And While You Were Sleeping, like, is that the one where she, like, you know, pretends to be married to this guy in a coma and, like, it's at Christmas? What the hell is that? But everything that Speed does in the service of its genre, While You Were Sleeping does as well, just as effectively. And they are both carried by Sandra Bullock being just incredible on screen and making you like her in spite of whatever ridiculous situation that she's put in.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, there's something... I read a contemporaneous review of not just the movie, but of Sandra Bullock. I think it was written in the mid-90s, maybe after Speed, after this, and she was really soaring. And someone sort of referred to her as Jimmy Stewart in a woman's body.
Okay.
Just because she's like someone who has a heightened ordinariness that makes us believe that ordinary people like us could be amazing when called upon to do amazing things.
Heightened ordinariness is... a questionable compliment, but I think it is. I think it is correct.
Yeah,
because like I think of the things that I like about her performances, and as you've alluded to, I'm an incredibly huge Sandra Bullock fan. But not in the way that I know that you talk about on this show, people being born under a diva star, and like Sandra Bullock's not my diva star. Like she's not my Cher or my Mariah Carey or whatever. But like I just think she's really great in a way that we perhaps don't credit her for, and that's maybe because. The central thing of a lot of her great performances are she's just an ordinary gal, you know? They're not really high, crazy. She's not doing a Sophie's Choice movie. She's not doing these big kind of Oscar plays. She's not doing these big heightened performances. She is being an ordinary person in ordinary places. And the thing that she does that I think makes her really great, I often think about these little moments, that it's just when she's driving a bus in Speed and you really believe that she's driving that bus and she's got to turn the wheel to make it round that corner and she's just looking at Bill Pullman and being in love in a token booth on the Chicago subway and she's just like brushing her chin with her fingers,
always touching her mouth
like Meryl does that. Is that the scene? But heightened ordinariness, you're quite right, that's really what brings her and her performances to life, I think.
And similar to Jimmy Stewart, if you met somebody who was acting like Jimmy Stewart in real life, you'd be like, this guy is a lot. And with her, it's like, she's a fucking knockout. She's a stunning woman. And now that I look across from you, it looks like she could be your mum.
Stop that.
She
don't add like more complicated reasons why I might like this movie.
She could be. Everyone, I'm sure, is on their phone right now googling Sam and finding that he is shockingly handsome and the one true child of Sandra Bullock.
If I turn out to like Sandra Bullock just because she looks a bit like me, that's really sad. But I guess we've all learned a lesson here today. Can I also ask a weird question? Is the title of this episode, as it appears on the podcast feed, going to be While You Were Sleeping with Sam Sedgman?
Oh my God, that just occurred to me. Oh, this is so good.
It occurred to me on the way in, and it sounds a little bit like a text you might get from a clinic. But
while you were sleeping with Sam Sedgman, we took a swab.
Okay.
We took a swab after While You Were Sleeping with Sam Sedgman, and the results are problematic.
We swabbed your tears to see what emotions you were feeling. And one of them was great sadness.
Oh, wow.
No, okay.
Should I do a plot summary?
Please do, because we have gone off the rails
here. Off the rails. While You Were Sleeping with Sam Sedgman. Anyway. God. Right, so... Lucy is a Chicago subway employee who is desperately alone and spends her days fixated on Peter, a businessman who takes the train between 8 and 8:15 every morning. When Peter is pushed off the tracks and into a coma, Lucy is mistaken by his large and charming family for his fiancé. While his older brother Jack is suspicious of her, Lucy gets in deep with the O'Callaghan family and finally finds a family of her own.
A sweaty premise.
Oh my God.
A very sweaty premise. But I would say one that does not feel sweaty. One that's delivered with great ease.
Explain to me a sweaty premise.
Oh, okay. I mean, I feel like we all know what this means. A movie story or something that has to really work up a sweat to get you to get you in gear for where this story is going to go.
Yeah.
There's a lot of setup involved. There's a lot of characters, a lot of moving parts, a lot of goodwill. Uh-huh. You really got to, you know, like someone telling you a story down at the pub, but like having to like pull you by the sleeve, being like, no, listen, like, listen, okay. Sure, there are like 8 characters you need to know about, and we were like at the Grand Canyon, and it was raining, okay, but it was also a Thursday. Like, you know, go.
Yeah.
But once you get there, it may well be a great story. Sweaty premise. But the thing...
Because it's very interesting to me, because the first time I ever heard the phrase sweaty premise, I was telling you a story in a pub.
I'd forgotten that.
And I was telling you the plot of my next novel, and you went, well, that sounds like it could be a very sweaty premise, but good luck.
I'm really excited to read your novel. I just want to say that.
Okay, I'm sure.
High concept is another way of putting this.
But that's my question, actually. I think it's an interesting phrase if you're somebody who is interested in story structure. Mm. Because what is the difference between a sweaty premise and high concept?
So I think high concept kind of implies like parallel universe or a big leap of imagination, like a central premise that's big. Whereas a sweaty premise is maybe like complicated or muddy, or like there's a lot of moving parts to it. Yeah. You know what I mean? So similar, but I think quite different. In the way that like while you were sleeping, there's the whole... I guess it is high concept, but also it's kind of the opening 10 minutes where you get to the premise, which is, okay, it's Christmas time and she's alone and she works at the toll booth on the subway and she's in love with this guy and her dad's dead, and then she saves his life and they get to the hospital and she pretends to be his fiance or the nurse and then she meets the family and then it's Christmas. there's a lot going on there. But I think the reason I said sweaty premise is because I don't think this movie makes it feel sweaty at all. It glides into this ridiculous scenario with great ease, and you never feel like you're kind of scraping on the edges of the tracks here. Like, this is a very well-oiled storytelling machine that gets you into that hospital room with the family, and you're like, oh, they think that she's his fiancé. And that's when the movie
starts. And the craft of those turns, I find... It's like watching great figure skating or something. Yes. You're like, yes, they landed the jump. like even to the point where, you know, she is established early on as like somebody who grew up just with their dad and now their dad is dead. And that world was very filled with dreams and dreaming. Mm. And it's interesting because it has this prologue that's very like, it's like a sort of a parody on like, isn't it weird how we're doing a flashback at the beginning of the movie?
It's but so orange. What the hell?
Yeah. And it's kind of, I imagine when I was watching, again, because I watched for the first time last night, but then between podcasts this afternoon, I read the entire script and had real appreciation for the formalism of that, of like somebody who's established early on as being very alone and very lives in a dream world.
Yeah. And also, I think the thing that makes the sadness really hit for me, like the deep well of sadness and all the stuff to do with loneliness and her parents being dead, is because whenever she talks about it, she's telling a joke about it.
Yeah.
Which is clearly her coping mechanism for that. You know, when we get the prologue at the beginning, she's making jokes about her dad and Milwaukee and like all the adventures that go on. When she has that really kind of moving conversation with Saul, the next door neighbor, the godfather, on the steps outside the house just before she goes in for Christmas, she's like, well, we had to move to Chicago because he was sick and we had to go to a research hospital. And then he decided he'd have enough research and then he died. Yeah. And you can
and
tell
that's how people are.
Yeah, they build armor for themselves out of humor. And it is heartbreaking because she does it with such a smile and she's doing it to be winning and also to kind of sort of like apologize for her own grief.
Yeah.
Like in the way that she's like, I'm telling you a sad story, but I don't want to bum you out.
I know that, and that it's so real. It's like and we've all had a situation like that. We'll have something in our lives that's a bit sad, and we've all had a conversation where it's like, "Oh, you don't know this, but he actually died, and I don't want you to feel bad about it because you weren't to know."
Yeah. And like, and so here's a little joke to make you feel better.
So human, yeah.
And it would be easy for this movie to be like treacly and have her crying in all of those moments. Mm. But I think, and she does cry a couple of times in this movie, but she's smiling when she cries.
Yeah.
She cries at the wedding, the aborted wedding, which we'll talk about. It always makes me cry.
Oh, wow.
Oh, like, there are some ridiculous lines in it that are just absolute clangers that I think, this is the dumbest line I've ever heard in my life. And then the next line will come along and I'll be in tears.
Yeah, I can really see that because the comedy is so good.
Yeah,
as
and,
well.
And they don't all hit, but like they mostly hit.
They mostly hit. So we've already established this is a great movie in terms of craft and character and Sandy's performance and everything. But this is sentimental garbage. And we can talk about craft all the live long day, but I'd love to know what this sort of means to Sam Sedgman.
Oh, the sentimental part of sentimental garbage. Okay. Yeah, because I have been thinking about this because, you know, we have been talking for a while about me coming on and doing something, and I was like, what do I want to talk about? And I love Sandra Bullock. I mean, so this movie entered my life at Christmas time, as it does, you know, for many people. And it's a movie my mother loves. And I guess, yeah, you can chart my Sandra Bullock interest from Speed when I was 13. Because like a lot of teenage kids, you know, I love that movie where the bus explodes. and then that, like, sells me on Sandy. And then my mum is watching this rom-com every Christmas called While You Were Sleeping. And it has trains in it. And for listeners who don't know, I'm a huge train person.
Yeah, and please briefly explain your train credentials.
Sure. I've written, I'm a children's author, and I've written a series of books called Adventures on Trains with my very good friend MG Leonard. They are sort of adventure mystery stories for 8 to 12-year-olds set on railway journeys all over the world. And I'm mad about trains and mass transit generally.
Very much no sweaty premises, just a guy who loves trains.
Yeah.
And has made that into a dazzling career.
I mean, they turn up on railway journeys around the world and there's a murder or there's a jewel thief.
That's
and
great.
Why do we care why that's happening? It's here. Let's go. but no, While He Was Sleeping obviously has trains in it. Very iconic train, the Chicago L. One of the most iconic pieces of mass transit, I'd say, in the world.
Okay, go on.
Oh, have you been to Chicago?
No.
Go to Chicago.
I've never been to that part of America at all. I've only been to the South.
Mm. Well, Chicago, I went to Chicago to take a train because I went from Chicago.
You go many places to take trains.
I really do.
It's adorable.
Traveling places to travel is a thing that I do because I've written these books. And so I wanted to take the California Zephyr, which is a train that goes from Chicago to San Francisco and takes 3 days and 2 nights and is one of the most beautiful railway journeys in the world. Goes through the Rocky Mountains and you follow the Colorado River.
Wow.
There's like desert and snow and bears. It's like an incredible journey. And that's where the second book in our kids' book series was set. So I wanted to do it for research and I went for my birthday. And Chicago is a really interesting city. It's the third largest city in America and you cannot escape the L there. It's the elevated train that just kind of clatters all the way through the middle of the city. And the center of like downtown Chicago is defined by the loop, which is the loop of track of the L that kind of encircles some city blocks at the center of downtown. And Chicago is one of those cities that has a really strong sense of identity and like one of the most pronounced senses of it. Like New York has it as well, but Chicago, people from Chicago love to tell you that from Chicago. and like it has a great flag. It's a very famously like iconic city flag with like 4 red stars and blue and white stripes. It's a very like bold piece of graphic design. But also I feel like in the 90s when this movie came out, Chicago was like really everywhere in the culture.
Yes. Yeah. John Hughes and like there was and lots of movies.
Oprah was in Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago Bulls, obviously, like Michael Jordan. Like every David E. Kelly television drama was set in Chicago. Like,
yeah, a lot of rappers coming out of there as well.
Yeah, it was like a huge, in a way that I feel like it's not so much true anymore. And I'm not quite sure like why.
The Bear.
The Bear. Oh yeah, The Bear is bringing it back for Chicago.
Yeah.
but no, so Chicago, really strong sense of itself. And the L is like such a huge, like iconographic part of Chicago's identity in a way that's like, kind of like the Tube is for London, but like what if the Tube is like on the street and you could see it all the time.
Mm-hmm. But it's not, so it's not a tram.
No, it's just like a metro system on stilts.
God, I hadn't thought of how weird that is. And not like the DLR.
No.
Because it's going plowing right through the city.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like it does
that. That is mad.
It does it in some parts of New York as well, but like not all of it and not in the center. Yeah, it's just like, and it's called the L because it's the elevated train. And it was like kooky and weird when it got built and now it's perfectly normal.
Yeah, it feels very turn of the century.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the great things that kind of we've lost from city identity is the thing that Sandra Bullock's job is in this film is to like take the subway token. Yes. You would buy like these tokens in advance, like instead of tickets, and you would be able to keep them in like your wallet, your purse, whatever, and give them to the attendant and kind of go through the barriers. And I don't think they, I know they got rid of them in New York a few years ago, but I don't think they have them in Chicago anymore either.
It's deliciously analog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just a way that like jobs that don't exist anymore that are really iconic.
Yeah.
And very of their time.
Yeah.
But you asked me my feelings.
Yes.
And I talked to you about subway tokens.
No, but I'm so, I loved hearing about that.
But that, I feel like that's one of the reasons that rom-coms are often so great, right? It's because they're of the business of everyday life. Like, that's what really brings them to life. And that's, I think, one of the reasons this one pops out is because it's about, like, a very specific setting. Like, on the rails in the office of the token booth, rather.
Yeah, you're so right. It's also what I miss about dating, in that, like, you...
Mm.
Because I think in the way of women being people-pleasing and very porous, it's, like, just going out with a guy for, like, 5 times, and he's really into one thing, and I get to learn a bit about it.
Like what? Give me examples.
Oh, like, you know, my ex-boyfriend was like a really big gamer and he worked in the industry. And then I developed an adult love of gaming through it. And that stayed with me my whole life. And I haven't spoken to him in 12 years.
That's interesting though. And that is like the geography of like dating someone and like the early part of a relationship and what you see in a rom-com.
Yeah.
And I know like I'm a huge Nora Ephron fan as well. And like one of the reasons I really love her scripts is the simplicity and that, like, you have the conversation and they're always doing a thing. They're always like in a place, they're always like at the batting cages or like buying a book or like, and the setting does so much for it. And that's not quite as on show in While You Were Sleeping, but like the reason it's interesting is because of the specificity of hospital and the token booth at the L.
And also it made me think a lot about the tradition of Christmas films and about so much of Christmas movies when you're trying to make it for kind of a broadly non-Christian audience.
Yeah.
Or not, I mean, well, obviously with all American movies, there's an implicit Christianity in everything. but you're making a Christmas movie that isn't about God and it's not for children.
Yes.
And so what is it? And I think, you know, so much of it is about opulence versus poverty, right? Yeah. And so you like A Christmas Carol, for example, which is, you know, the most classic example of it, or It's a Wonderful Life, where you have like, again, Jimmy Stewart's very simple pared back life versus, you know, the opulence of like Pottersville or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, this is like a world where Sandy's world is like bare and pared back, and we really have a sense of how little money she has, and everything's grim and grey. And then you walk into the O'Callaghan's house for the first time, and it's like it's the McAllister's house in Home Alone.
Everything's busy. The wallpaper is busy. Every shelf is covered in something. Everyone is wearing like busy, like textured clothing, and it's loud, and it's, the lights are bright. And
they met her yesterday, but they have gifts for her because they're probably that kind of family that has gifts just stowed, you know?
My heart, when the camera pans up from Sandra Bullock, like hugging the present, like looking at everyone around her with like big saucer eyes, and the camera pans up to the mantelpiece where they have hung a makeshift stocking and written Lucy on it for her because they didn't want her to feel left out. And it's, oh my God.
It's so gorgeous.
So when you write a movie about...
That's my favourite part of the whole movie was that.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
So like you said, you know, it's about Christmas, but it's not about Christmas. It's about... So whenever a movie is about Christmas, it kind of takes something, I think, and focuses on a non-God part of Christmas. Right?
Yeah.
And this is very much focusing on family. Mm. And there's a line that she has on the stoop where she's talking to Saul and she says like, it's really important to have family this time of year. She says someone without family to someone who does. And that's a heartbreaking observation as well. Because her dad died, I think, she says, last year. So this is like the second Christmas that she's been without her dad,
okay,
I think.
Okay.
So yeah, it's surprisingly recent. I'm not quite sure how old she's supposed to be. I think she was around 30 maybe when she made this film. Mm. But I think the character must be like early 20s or mid-20s. She said she had to quit school or something. And
I love being 30 and being your second big movie.
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah. She's...
I'm so tired of the movie stars being younger than me.
It's her... Just a little word on her longevity as well. Because, like, she started making movies in the 80s.
Yeah.
She pops in... She stars opposite Sylvester Stallone in Demolition Man. But, like, her first kind of breakout is Speed.
She was in Demolition Man?
Oh, yeah. She's Lenina Huxley. The like
I love
sexy,
that movie.
Futuristic sidekick.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And but While He Was Sleeping is her first lead role, I think. Lead role in a major movie.
Yes.
And then she's basically lead and everything
after
until
the
present day. And she continues to be, I think last year she was still the highest paid actress in Hollywood because she made The Lost City for like $20 million. And she also pops up in Bullet Train. So she's like, she's sustained a career as a lead movie star for 30 years, which is insane to me. And quite rare. And I think the reason it's insane is also she has somehow like not penetrated the cultural, like the pop culture consciousness in the way that like we're all obsessed with Jennifer Aniston.
Yes.
Or like, she's not like a tabloid person like that. Her personal life is fundamentally uninteresting to the culture for the most part.
Yeah, or like even Nicole Kidman, who's like her contemporary, but there's like memes with Nicole Kidman of her in that cinema and like her and Tom Cruise and like there's a thing, you know. I compare it to Kirsten Dunst as well, somebody who we all love by virtue of them just building up a great body of work.
Yeah, like, we like her because she's been around for a while. And also, and like, she's really good at smiling.
Yeah.
And like, I have no ill will to her. And also, she's really good at what she does. But yeah, she's not like, you know... And I say this as like someone who's a huge fan, but like I don't think you get like stans for Sandra Bullock in the way that you get like big stans for Nicole Kidman, especially like Oscar nerds and movie buffs. Like,
yes,
people like have really strong feelings about Julianne Moore in a way that they do not have any feelings about Sandra Bullock.
That's our really strong feelings about like Toni Collette or Allison Janney.
Yeah,
you know,
Laura Dern. Yeah,
yes, like. Yes. That's so interesting because like if we're talking about, I don't know. You and I are talking about a very specific kind of person that I know you and I both know. Like that sort of person who's like, they're really into Best Supporting Actresses. Like, they're just like super into Laura Dern, super into, your Toni Collettes or whatever. And then there's people who are into movie stars, who are into like Jennifer Lawrence and Nicole Kidman.
Yes.
And like Sandy's kind of in the middle.
Yeah, like she'll headline a movie and people want to go see her in a movie. And if she's in a movie, I'm seeing it. But I don't really need to read gossip magazines about her.
Yeah.
And I don't really, I mean, I don't kind of feel like I need to root for her like people root for Annette Bening to win a Best Supporting Actor nomination for something. Like, yeah, you're right. She kind of straddles weirdly both of those worlds.
Nor am I sitting around thinking about understanding her the way I think about Julia Roberts so frequently.
Yeah.
I burn calories thinking about Jennifer, like Julia Roberts' fucking motive for her life.
And I rarely think about Sandra Bullock, but when she turns up in my head, it's always a nice surprise.
There she is,
being great. And yeah, just being ruthlessly charismatic in everything she does and making you really care about her character, whatever a ridiculous thing that she's doing.
And it's also, if we think about like, you know, this and also Miss Congeniality and 2 weeks notice, it's always like a person that's like coming in sort of like, I don't know, and then hang on, I'm incredibly charming and now everyone loves me, and it's like it starts kind of staccato and then it relaxes into itself and we're like, that's me when I'm awkward, and then I become delightful.
exactly that. And also, she's not often sexy, a thing I think is very important to this movie. Mm-hmm. She's obviously an incredibly beautiful woman, but rarely like required to be like a sexual object or like in the way that like a lot of actresses have to do in movies and or to make a career. She's I remember seeing her on I think Graham Norton's show once, like talking about how she only does nudity when it's funny. Like famously The Proposal, like where the like her and Ryan Reynolds like run in and like their naked bodies like slap into each other when they're out the shower, and it's just like hilarious. It's a hilarious nude scene.
Yeah.
She's not doing a lot of like erotic sex scenes.
I love that.
And this movie, you know, while he was sleeping, like there's no makeover scene. There's no like she takes her glasses off and suddenly Bill Pullman falls in love with her. She wears jumpers at the beginning, she wears jumpers at the end. It's Christmas, it's cold, and we love her for it. No one, like, has a big makeover. We like her because she's kind and nice, and she just doesn't want to hurt anyone. And we feel sorry for her, and we want good things for her. Like, you know, the man doesn't go, huh? Like, when she takes off the coat, and underneath is, like, a little black dress.
There's none of that.
There's none of that at all.
It would have been so easy, especially her going to, like, their dinner or whatever, for her to be like, oh, yeah, here's my little dress or whatever.
Yeah, she dresses up fancy, and that's when Bill Pullman notices her. No, Bill Pullman, like, falls in love with her when they move a sofa together.
Yeah.
And like, she makes a stain on his brother's carpet by knocking over that vase or whatever. Like, and they have that, like, they fall in love in a way that, like, you believe actual people like each other, not, like, looking at someone going, da-doy, like, you know, in a way that feels real and interesting. And actually completely different to Because the movie begins with, there's a line about, like, do you believe in love at first sight or something? Mm-hmm. And the idea that she's in love with Peter Gallagher, whatever. Peter Callahan. The actor is Peter Gallagher. The character is Peter Callahan.
Yeah, which Peter Gallagher is very good humoured about. He's like, yeah, I was playing a lot of dickheads in movies. And I guess, I mean, they called him Peter Callahan, so.
He plays a dickhead so well, though.
He's just got that face.
Yeah. But so, like, the movie sets up that she's fallen in love with this guy at first sight. And then slowly reveals that he is yuppie scum. My favourite bit is when, of him, like, you slowly reveal this throughout the movie, like, when you hear his voicemail.
Yeah.
And when you first get Ashley Bartlett Bacon leaving a voice note saying, what the hey, I will marry you. His voicemail is like, this is Callahan. Leave a message. Ciao.
Oh, he sucks.
And he has, like, a picture of himself holding a tennis racket in his wallet.
Oh, my God. Yes.
It's so, like, subtly introduced that, like, she should not be falling for this guy. But then you meet him.
I could have done with more of that.
Yeah.
I love that. I loved when Saul is like, you're a putz.
Yeah.
You've always been a putz. No one likes you. This is your best opportunity to be a decent person.
Yeah.
That is actually what sells it as, like, because the final sort of quarter is mad.
Oh, my God. The proposal, the wedding, the other proposal, the other wedding.
Yeah.
It all happens so fast in a movie that takes place over 2 weeks. Like, it's bananas. But yeah, the fact that, like, you don't feel bad for him. But also he plays it very well, and that he's just like, he's quite upset to be called a putz, but also he kind of knows that he is. And I
really admire his performance in it, because it's like, it's really believable of, like, first of all, he's asleep for most of the movie.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up and it's like, you know, that thing of, okay, well, something extreme has happened to me. This is like, got to be a calling from something or somewhere. And, like, looking at my life before, and now all my family love this beautiful girl I've never seen. And, like, I'm going to marry her. Yeah.
My family loves you. I might as well love you. A ridiculous line that you buy in the moment, because it's performed very well.
Another ridiculous line I really bought in the moment was when Sandra Bullock's one friend, Jerry, who's her manager.
Oh my God, she has no friends. Her only friend is her boss. It's so sad.
And her boss has no fucking clue what's going on the entire time. The way I just loved it so much. The way she keeps, like, explaining the plot of the movie, and he's like, huh?
They have, like, doctors for this kind of thing.
So at one point, Gavin, like, jumped out of his seat. One point he screams, well, your boyfriend is a vegetable. It was like, can he say that?
Yeah, I don't think you could say that now, but he said it at the time. It is bonkers. It's so sad that she doesn't have any friends.
I know, because, like, that's the thing. The rom-com, it lives and dies on the best friend.
So often you have the best friend.
And then you have auxiliary friends, like, and You've Got Mail or whatever, or Harry Met Sally. They all have best friends.
Like. One thing that struck me as really weird watching it this time was Sandy is, like, alone, and she works in the token booth. But, like, the woman who works behind her, it's like, what's her name? Celeste,
I think.
Yeah. Celeste. And she goes to her New Year's Eve party, and she's got hundreds of friends.
Yeah, so
she's doing great.
It's not, like, unique to working on the.
It's not like the poor, sad, lonely, you know, token booth girl. It's because she has an inner sadness. That's what it is. Yeah. But yeah, no best friend, which I think is a really interesting calculus for a rom com. Obviously, like, the boss kind of fulfills that role, but that just reinforces how sad it is.
Right, and it's also this thing that And it's quite a pat joke, but when it's, like, strong with all these other little beads, it makes a very heartbreaking portrait, which is like, you know, oh, the hot dog guy never remembers her order.
The usual. What's that?
The usual. And it's this kind of notion that it's not that she's unlikable or that she's, you know, repellent. It's just that there's a kind of a thinness in essence to her.
Yes.
Like, she's kind of a wraith almost.
Very much gets at, I've moved to the big city and I don't like it.
Yeah.
Which I think is a real, you know, so many of these kind of movies are about women moving to the big city and self-actualizing. And this is...
So maybe her movies are like that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, like, that's maybe one of the reasons it's, like, continued to resonate with me as an adult is, like, you know, the idea that the city is a vibrant place, but, like, the life that you build for yourself there can be very thin and it's very fragile.
Yeah.
And, like, you want human connection so much. And it's not... The romance plot in this is beautiful and lovely, but, like, the conclusion of they get married without ever having kissed, like, or he proposes to her and they haven't kissed, they haven't gone on a date. It's madness. It's not really about romance. It's about human connection in a more general way, right?
Yes.
She wants a family. She wants to be seen. She wants to be noticed. She wants to be loved. Mm. Like, she needs to have an anchor point in her life, and she lost that with her family. And I think that's something that we all want. Like, and in a city, it's very hard and very difficult to find that.
It's so interesting when you look at this movie under the context of, I mean, I think the character is probably like 26, 27.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If you look at it under the guise of, this is a person who's been in the city for 2 years and most of that time was spent caring for their parent.
Yeah.
And now they are adrift and they have no connection and no home place to go to.
Yeah.
And it's like, as somebody who moved to a city from somewhere else, it's like, it really hits different when you see it in that lens.
Yeah. And it's really interesting that I feel like so many movies are made that have like a similar shape of story or whatever, but they don't get at something that feels real and true. And the like the loneliness of the city is really feels like that to me. And it looks so interesting, Chicago, in this movie, I think. And I think, because it's obviously Christmas, that it's so dark a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Like,
which is, again, why I remembered it as a thriller, because it's so dark.
Yeah, yeah. It's so, like, and it's dark and cozy a lot of the time, but, like, you really, like, see people, like, curling away into their jumpers and their coats. The snow really looks like snow, even though it is not snow.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's a real problem with digital filmmaking is that fake snow never looks like snow anymore.
That's true. It's, yeah, they've advanced the technology too far and it's unpleasant to look at now.
Yeah, I remember watching The Holiday, the Nancy Meyers movie, and like, God love that movie. The snow does not look like snow. It looks like little bits of shaved coconut. Like it.
That's always what it looks like, coconut. You're dead right.
That's often what it is, I think, or certainly used to be.
Really?
But yeah, like, you know, when like Cameron Diaz gets like a face full of snow in that movie, you're like, that's not snow. Whereas this one, you know, They're out and about, like, falling over on the ice or whatever. You're like, that's not ice. That's, like, Perspex covered in olive oil or whatever. But, like, it looks like snow and slush because the movie has a sort of fuzzy, dark, this was filmed on celluloid look to it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think movies from the 90s always have that certain quality and feel to them, in that they feel cozy and specific in that way.
How does Bill Pullman hit for you?
Interesting casting, Bill Pullman.
Yeah.
So I think he was delighted to get romantic lead rather than being... Yes. I don't know what he was doing before this. I know that he's like the one you don't want Meg Ryan to end up with
in Sleepless in Seattle. Yes. And he's a wonderful interview that I've found. I can't remember if it's in that oral history we both read or a profile of him I read on the archive of the New York Times. But he said that when he was on set of Sleepless in Seattle, he was like, sure, I'll play the clumsy guy. There's like a great... The honor in being a comic foil like whatever. And then he was like, you know, Nora's obviously this powerhouse and he's there with Meg Ryan. And he's like, yeah, I can do this and whatever. And then that he just like sat in the cinema and just felt so embarrassed.
Oh,
and
Bill.
Just like, just he felt really ashamed. And because like he's such a unfuckable character in it.
In a
and
way like, that I, so I remember watching this with my ex-boyfriend in Seattle, who has some allergies. Oh. And he was like, the only reason you're not supposed to like Bill Pullman is because he has allergies.
Yeah.
There's no, he's a very nice guy. He just has some allergies.
That's it.
That movie really does like bad promo for people with allergies.
For the allergic community.
So I feel really bad for Bill Pullman.
Yeah.
But yeah, in this, he is like a very thin character. Like a lot of romantic leads are, I would say. He's good at carpentry.
The Prince Eric effect, you know.
Yeah, very true. But yeah, Bill Pullman has very good charisma in this. You don't meet him for like a good half hour into the movie because we're dealing with all of this coma nonsense.
He comes so late.
But you really like him because him and Sandy have like a really warm, great chemistry. And I think because they start off as his role is to actively interrogate her story and he doesn't like her and he's suspicious of her.
For which there is no stakes for him to feel that way.
No,
like, no stakes for him to be as invested in defrauding her as he is.
He sees her back as she's lying on a sofa and he's like, that's not Peter's fiance.
Yeah, and I guess like...
Why? How do you know? You've never met her.
I guess what I took from that was that he met the blonde girl.
Ashley Bartlett Bacon. A woman named after breakfast meat. Who has like three scenes and nails them. Knocks them out of the park. The way she kind of like awkwardly turns corners and almost falls off her heels and her purse goes flying.
Oh my God.
Like that actually had a great time.
She was available for the oral history, wasn't she?
Yeah. She really was. And we love her for it.
I find it so funny with oral history is like who really you could tell like is giving paragraphs of dialogue and who's just like, yeah, we had a good time.
Yeah, it was a great time.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
But no, Bill is really good. Can we talk about the jobs that romantic leads have in rom-coms?
Yes, desperate.
So he is like...
Oh, this is fucking stupid. Me and Gav were roaring about this. Go on.
Oh, yeah. So in While He Was Sleeping, Bill Pullman works for his dad, Mr. Callahan, and for Callahan and Son estate salespeople. So they buy furniture off dead people and then sell them.
Yeah.
And it was Callahan and Sons, but Peter left to become a yuppie scumbag lawyer. And Bill Pullman...
Which, just even that, I have so many questions for.
Oh, that's like... a whole thing. But, like, again, that's a whole world that makes you really believe that it's real in the way that...
Does it?
Well, I believe that there is emotional depth there that the movie can mine, rather than, like, he has an ordinary job or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, his passion is carpentry. His passion and, like... We like him because we're supposed to like him when it's revealed that he can make a rocking chair that's really nice. You know, it's implied that he works with his hands.
Yes.
You know, a very kind of sexy, appropriate...
He drives a big van around.
Very, like, blue-collar, lead, romantic lead profession, being a carpenter. Sometimes rom-coms give their leading men, like, really stupid jobs, and I just think it's quite funny when they give him, like... I think there's one... Like, you know, in the Christmas, in like the classic Hallmark, they're often like a Christmas tree farmer or something like that.
Oh, sure. My favorite one is the Reese Witherspoon one, Sweet Home Alabama, where he's a glass blower and his whole deal is he gets in his heliplane or whatever. It's like, you know, that's a weird plane that's a boat. And
yeah.
He like chases thunderstorms to find thunder that's been hit by lightning
what?
That hits the sand and creates a kind of a glass. And then he works with the glass and he's very good at it and he's had quite a fortune.
This is like the movie Twister mixed with a rom-com.
Yeah, it's not great. I'd love to cover it. One day.
One day. Yeah. Another show. Mm-hmm. No, I wonder, I feel like maybe that's the secret though. Like glass blower, carpenter. If you could make like a cozy reality series about that profession, it's the perfect job to give your romantic lead in a show.
Oh, totally. And it's the Aidan Shaw effect as well, isn't it?
Oh, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
I never liked Aidan, but I get it. Yeah.
We all get it. We all want to feel small.
But we do all want to feel small. We like him because he's a carpenter, but like I don't really care that he's a carpenter. The carpenter stuff for me is like interesting because he has to have a difficult conversation with his dad about how he doesn't want his dad's business.
Right, and it's over in like a second.
Yeah, and like it doesn't matter that it's over in a second to me, and like there are no stakes and it's very fine, but it's very much a parallel with he needs to own up about something to his dad. Sam needs to own up about something to his dad. And also, it's, you know, as a gay person, like... having a difficult conversation with your parents.
Yeah.
Very, very a mood. you know. And also, you know, not to get too deep too quick. Like, it's too quick. We talk about like an hour and a half. Yeah. No, like, that's maybe one of the reasons this is particularly a resonant movie for me as a gay person is because, like, this is about having a secret you can't tell the family you're with at Christmas.
Oh,
you know
wow.
what I mean? What if I tell them this thing and they all leave me and I'm alone?
Oh my God.
That's a very, like, I think that's why it's a resonant movie for queer people in particular, as well as the whole, like, going to the city and trying to find a family for yourself, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of, like, calculus working under the surface here in a way, like, why this hits different for certain people. Like, if you're someone who's moved to the big city and you're, like, working at a job you don't like, it hits on that level. If you're someone who has complicated feelings about your family, there's that level. If you're someone who's suffered grief, like, there's a lot of weird things about this movie that just seem to sort of hit different people in different ways and give them the feels. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, I carry around any kind of huge trauma about being gay or anything. Like, I came out when I was 18, my family were great about it. But yeah, like it's a certain kind of emotional thing that, you know, you have with you. And I definitely feel like it resonated with me on some level in this bananas movie about a woman who works in mass transit.
It's so interesting that you say that, because, I mean, there are many rom-coms that sort of operate on a deception, right?
Yeah.
Like, but I do understand why this one would hit different, because the kind of, again, as we've said, the loneliness feels so lonely and the bareness feels so bare. And then the sort of nuclear family thing and everything having everyone having their role and everyone having a place. It's like, it feels so good that, like, why would you say something and upset grandma?
Yeah, it's a very high concept movie, sweaty premise. Like, it's a very complicated setup, but the stakes are very clear and very simple.
Yeah.
In that, like, she's been welcomed into this family. That's good. But under false pretenses,
that's bad.
And literally, if you say the wrong thing around the dinner table at Christmas, your grandmother will have a heart attack and die. Something that, like, gay kids are often told, like,
I'm fine with it, but your
grandmother will, like, her intestines will explode.
Her intestines will explode. That was so funny.
Oh, God, yeah. So, yeah, it's, even though it's a ridiculous setup, like, the emotional stakes are very pure and very true. You know, like, it's just, like, about this family and her relationship to them. And that's quite clean and simple, which is maybe why it doesn't continue to feel bananas as you go through. And there are all these different, like, you know, plot points that come along the way. Like, the other fiancé comes along, the guy wakes up out of a coma.
Again, very late.
Very late. But, like, lots of things happen to keep the plot moving forward, but they're not stupid things. They're, like, quite ordinary things if you buy the initial premise. Yes. Whereas, like, a lot of movies would keep adding on business on top of other business. There'd be a train crash or her twin sister would show up, or, like, it's just, whereas, like, the things that happen are simple family developments. Mm. Like, they have to deliver a sofa. Like, the things that occur in the movie are quite small after this initial bigness of story. And that's why I think they feel real and feel resonant.
It's continuously fascinating to me, the kind of the propaganda that big families like elicit about themselves. Like, big family is like saying big pharma. Like, it's
big family.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I want to talk about the family stone, but that's not my job. My job is to talk about while he was sleeping.
Yeah.
I think, the big family in this movie is really interesting, right? Mm. Because Peter, the yuppie scum, clearly doesn't really want to have anything to do with the family.
No, because they all accept fairly quickly that he has a fiance that they don't know about.
He lives, and, like, visually his apartment is very different.
They all live in Chicago, so what's going on?
They all live in Chicago, but they don't talk. Yeah. And, like, he's a lawyer, whatever, he's busy. And, you know, we're supposed to think he's a bit stupid and idiot. But, like, he doesn't want to spend time with the big family.
No.
And, like, that's a choice that one could make, and it's not necessarily a bad choice, but the, like, in the context of the family, the idea that, like, they can't wait to, like, they really like Lucy in a way because they see her as, like, a conduit to getting him back in a way.
Oh, that's so good.
And, like, when he wakes
you're
up,
dead right,
he doesn't seem like that, like, oh God, mum, stop. Like, he doesn't play it that way, but also he does sort of act like a guy who's had a near-death experience and wants to change his life in a way. But he doesn't seem that close to his family.
Yeah.
He seems to live a very different life from them.
Yeah.
He got out of the family business early.
Yeah.
And why is that a problem? Like, you know, the idea at Christmas time of, like, that obligation to come back together for the family. Mm. And the rest of the family see, and it seems like a very lovely family, and they're all very, like, warm and welcoming, and that's great. But I wonder, would he have come back for Christmas if he had not been in a coma?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because he's taking the train on Christmas Day.
Oh, yes.
But where to?
Yeah, like, maybe, I mean, maybe to see his family, I don't know. But, like, no, he's carrying a briefcase.
He's carrying, yeah.
Is he working on Christmas Day?
Hell, yeah, somewhere.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. If they were to sort of Netflixify this and make it into sort of, like, eight...
unnecessary eight-part,
eight,
like,
episodes,
series.
40 minutes each.
You'd get, like, what, like, episode five would be, like, a flashback to Peter and, like, Jack as kids, like, when Peter leaves the family,
like,
business.
Like, when Saul immigrates to America.
Oh, my God. It would just unravel forever. Do not do that.
If
you're listening, producers,
however,
don't do that.
However, it's an interesting premise. It's fun. And I wouldn't hate it. And I also wouldn't hate if we fleshed out why Peter was estranged from the family. Because it's very clear to me that he was.
Yeah, there's something like he... You can tell from the furniture alone that he wants to live a very different kind of life.
Yeah.
You're supposed to hate his stupid modern apartment. I don't mind it.
I don't hate it at all.
I don't mind it. Like,
his American Psycho apartment.
I mean, I wouldn't have photographs of myself holding a tennis racket on the bar. But, you know, it seems like a cool
place.
It is
kind of fun to imagine a kind of mashup of, like, maybe Peter is Patrick Bateman.
Oh, my God.
Like, oh, wow, it's the first girl we've met. Yeah. Because it's the first one who's lived.
We never like to go around to his apartment because of all those murders that seem to happen in the building. But yeah,
him doing his push-up with his eye mask on.
Oh, God, though, now I'm thinking about it. Like, is it quite... How do we feel about, like, them, as an engagement present, giving him a sofa that he will clearly hate?
I know. He'll kill again.
No, like the family have a very strong dynamic and they all seem very happy to be there. But not everyone can thrive in that dynamic.
Yeah.
And Peter shouldn't. He can go and live his own life.
What's interesting about the dynamic as well is that it's very senior heavy. You know what I mean?
Yes. Okay.
Like, because I feel, okay, so we get the mum and the dad.
Yep.
And then do we also get, the mother's mother, so the
mother's
grand.
Mother, yep.
Do we get a grandfather and then we get Saul as well?
I don't think we have a grandfather. We just have Saul.
No, Saul is the grandfather.
Saul is the grandfather. Saul's the godfather.
Godfather.
Who lives next door.
Yes.
Who is the dad's best friend.
Best friend.
I think.
Right.
And then you've got the three kids, the much younger daughter, and then the two brothers.
Feels like there's a sibling missing, doesn't there?
Yeah, well, maybe there is. That can be another... That can be like season two when you write your Netflix drama. Stop shilling for screenwriting credits, Caroline.
Oh, this is four. This is not that profitable an enterprise. I need to get work from it.
Do you think that's a small family? You come from a huge family, though. What are your family Christmases like? Would that feel small to you? You've got, what, three siblings?
I've got three siblings, but they also have children and it's like...
Yeah, okay.
It is a little bit Home Alone family sort of vibe of like... That actually, the tenor of our Christmases and our family gatherings are taking on that vibe now of like, I can totally see a child getting left behind.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess, narratively, you don't want more characters in this because it's hard to keep track of them as it is.
Yeah, especially if you look at the family stone, that poor older sister.
Oh, so many feelings about this. The characters are introduced in the family stone and they have nothing to do. But no, like there's clearly a desire to have like the big family who all live in Chicago and come back for Christmas, and that's really great.
It's just weird, I think, to front load it with older people when you're doing a big family movie rather than having a mix of, I don't know, but they're great. I mean, they're all great actors.
But I guess you can't have, if some of them were married and had kids already, that like you need the of marriageable age children to be romantically available in order to make the plot function.
That's true.
But boy, do they love to get married. Can we talk about the speed with which they get married?
Okay, let's go on to let's hurtle towards the wedding.
So Saul, the godfather, having discovered the whole movie knows that this woman, Lucy, is
How does he know? I feel like I blinked and missed that.
He overhears at the hot... So in the middle of the night, she's been mistaken for this guy's fiancée. She goes home, doesn't know what to do about it. So she gets up in the middle of the night and goes to the hospital to talk to the guy in the coma about it because she has no friends and it's deathly sad. And then she delivers this incredible monologue, which was Sandra Bullock's audition for the role.
Yeah.
And she made everyone cry. I think they considered Julia Roberts, Demi Moore, and someone else.
Meg Ryan initially.
And they were
pitched it to Meg Ryan first as being like, it's going to be this guy who falls in love with you and you're in a coma. And they were like, why would she want that?
She's
in a coma, she's asleep, and also creepy.
Yeah, that's right. When it was a guy and a girl, and it was called Coma Guy, the early draft of this script.
Yeah.
It's much better as it is. But no, they rejected a lot of people because they described them as too pretty. What a weird...
Weird dig.
Yeah. I mean, like... Whatever. But anyway, Sandra got it with an audition, which is great. And that scene where she tells the comatose guy everything, the godfather is standing outside the door and hears everything and decides not to do anything about it because he, for whatever reason, God, he does so much heavy lifting plot-wise.
Yeah.
He doesn't tell anyone because he thinks it's good for the family to feel like they have Peter back in their lives through her questionable...
Again, I feel like that whole storyline needs another nod, that thing of like Peter's back kind of thing.
Yeah, you're right.
Do they ever explicitly say it or is it just inferred and therefore is it better writing because it's inferred?
I think it's better writing because it's inferred.
Okay.
And because this movie is a crisp 100 minutes. And we like that. But then when Peter wakes up, Saul tells him, he's trying to tell him, there's this woman, everyone thinks that she's your fiancée and she's not.
Yeah.
Instead, he goes, she's your guardian angel.
She's an angel.
And you, my friend, are a putz and you need to sort your life out. And the way you can sort your life out is by marrying Sandra Bullock. There. And he's like, you're all right.
And then so what old people think, though.
Yeah, a like, good marriage will sort this out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, again, because like, what? How do we fix your life? By bringing you into the family. Like, yeah, and yeah. like, you have been lost, my child, and you will be brought back into the family with this nice girl that we've picked out for you. And they then decide to get married the next day at the hospital.
At the hospital.
At the hospital. Which I guess, like, near-death experience, whatever, you can forgive that to a degree. And it's cute when she turns up and, like, hangs her coat on the guy's IV bag or whatever. And has, like, the saddest, weirdest wedding scene in a movie.
Yeah. I object.
I object, like, immediately. And then everyone else objects. And then the fiancé walks in.
Yeah.
And that's the big climax. And no one's mad at her, which I find really interesting. She gives this heartwarming speech about how she's betrayed all of them. And then they're mad at the sons. I think they say, like, Peter, how could you do this to us? And you're like, he's been in a coma.
Oh, he's done nothing.
Why are you always mad at Peter? No wonder he wanted to get away from you lot. Anyway, but it's she says, like, she has her, like, she says, I'm very sorry in a way that, like...
Only Sandy can.
Her voice cracks, to, like, every other line.
Yeah.
In a way that is just flawless and brilliant. And then, but then no one's mad at her and she slips out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the next scene is Bill Pullman proposing to her. By dropping the engagement ring.
In front of his whole family.
In front of his whole family. He says, presumably he told them, I'm going to propose to Lucy today, the day after she was going to marry my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Would you all like to come along and watch? And they go, sure, absolutely. We're all available. This is fine. And then they haven't gone on a real date.
No.
They haven't kissed, apart from under the mistletoe, like, which is creepy in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
And then... then they're married and that's the end of the movie.
That's the end.
Like, it's mad.
It is mad.
Like, I get it in like a sort of narrative satisfaction level. Yeah. But like, do we just sort of accept... I don't think people really did that in the 90s. It's just like, we kind of... At what point would that not have been mad?
It is odd because there is this rom-com boom in the 90s that we're all still picking over the carcass of still and some of us are making livings off of.
Sure.
But it is so interesting how... obsessed with marriage they are as a natural conclusion point.
Yes, yes.
Like My Best Friend's Wedding, like Runaway Bride, like they're all, it has to be marriage or nothing.
Yeah,
you know?
Like there's no in between.
Yeah, there's no move in together or like even just like a really beautiful romantic statement that is quite easy to write, you know?
Because in that last scene, she says to Celeste, well, she says last day, as though she's quit her job.
Yeah.
And she implies Sandra Bullock has decided that she's had enough of being a token booth person and is going to go off and go to Florence.
Also, the implication that she's not traveling the world because like she's not confident enough.
Oh my god, she's not traveling the world because she works a minimum wage job in a big city,
and she's probably still paying off her fucking dad's medical hospital bills. Yeah.
Oh my god, like, but no, but like, toughen up, Sandy. Like
toughen
what?
Up.
Like what?
You'd be a girl who works at the fucking transit office and plans vacations she's never going to take. It's like, ow,
she can't afford it, you monster.
You monster.
Who comes from this enormous family and like has not one job but two. And anyway, but there's an implication that she's going to quit her job and leave. Mm-hmm. And you could just rewrite the last scene with she's leaving, she's going to get on the train to leave Chicago and Bill Pullman comes and kisses her and that's the end of the movie.
And they go to Florence together or something.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
They don't get married, but they start dating. And like, it works still. But yeah, like, you're right.
And it being enough that it's like, none of us are mad at you. All of us love you. Come on back for lunch.
Yeah. Like, that's the narrative satisfaction we want. I don't want them to get married. Like, it's a weird obsession.
What was happening in the culture?
Because I find, like, it's so weird that's the thing you're going to die on the hill for. Like, I think it makes it worse. And I think people in the 90s knew it was stupid.
Yeah.
But we kind of don't question it. And now it's so far away. It's so stupid now that, like, we don't really mind.
Maybe it's something to do with this sort of... It's interesting because we, you know... We think about these movies in comparison to the movies that are being made now. We're like, they really made good movies back then.
Yeah.
But that burst of mid-90s rom-coms came after a quite a long dry spell for rom-coms. Mm. Like, there wasn't a lot going on for a while. There was stuff like Working Girl that was like, you know, very much an office. It was dealing with women in office stuff or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it had been a dry thing. And I read some articles today that was like, lots of studio heads weighing in on the boom kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they very much talking about it referencing sort of the 30s and the 40s of like these, you know, Hepburn and Tracy kind of like...
Yeah.
the idea of like building a movie around the chemistry of two beautiful leads.
Yes.
As opposed to building it around, you know.
Yes.
Other stuff. And I guess those movies always end in marriage, so yeah, therefore, 30 years ago,
they had to get married at the end of it.
Yeah.
And now I guess we have to do that too.
Sometimes those 60s movies, there'd be a double wedding at the end.
Oh my God. You know? Yes. Very Shakespearean.
Yeah.
I think, but it is worth it for the last shot of the just married on the back of the L train, though.
Oh, that is
like,
nice.
That's iconic. And we'd have to lose that if they don't get married at the end.
Okay, so this is from The Oral History, which is on the Washington Post, and it's Bill Pullman. And I think it's important to contextualize that. Like, this is Sandra Bullock's first big rom-com. It's his first big rom-com leading role. They've had this incredible time in Chicago. And he says, "One of the most stunning moments was on our last day. All of a sudden, John," who's the director, "took Sandra's hand and my hand, and he just said, 'Run.' And we ran away. We ran way out into a cornfield near where we were shooting and put our heads really close together. He said, 'I just want you to know that no matter what response to the movie we get, this experience has been so filled with joy. And I love you, people.'"
It sounds like the most lovely and fun movie. Because often you read stories about making a movie and they're like, it was hell. It took like 18 weeks. We had to do reshoots and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And this just sounds like they all had a really, really lovely time.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that this movie was a phenomenal success and like has continued to be taken into the culture and like gently mocked, as we've talked about, but still really beloved. The writers never had another movie made.
What?
Yeah, which is bizarre. I think they like made a lot of money by like writing movies that never got made.
Oh,
but
no.
Yeah, like it never happened. I mean, it happened for them. It literally happened in this movie. But yeah, they didn't then go on and have a hugely long career, I don't think, which is really odd.
Yeah.
But also, I think when I thought about that, I was like, the script isn't really what makes this movie good. It's all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you think about their script, it was originally called Coma Guy. And it was supposed to be about Meg Ryan in a coma and a guy stalking her. Like, you know, the magic is not there. The magic is in Sandra Bullock, like, wearing a jumper and pulling a present out of the enormous sleeve of her jumper.
Oh.
And the chemistry of those two leads and the family. And like a lot of the lines, I think, were improvised. I don't drink anymore. I don't drink any less either. And there's like a sort of onset magic of the production that has made this thing that is really wonderful. And it's not really like, again, like the director's not like a famous rom-com director.
He directed Cool Runnings.
There you go. Another famous rom-com.
Cool Runnings and Three Ninjas at High Noon.
Interesting.
Which I think
filmography.
Very. And I think are very much regarded as kind of classics of sort of breakfast cartoon Saturday morning movies. Like VHS, you're with your brother in your pajamas kind of thing.
Yes.
But very much big flops at the time and huge losses.
And so, this film has a certain sparkle and a certain magic, but I don't think it's attributable to any one part of it, apart from Sandra Bullock, probably. Because
there are some great dialogue scenes with those older actors, though.
That's true. That is true.
The thing with it's just... Gavin, when we were watching it, he was like, this is what it's like having dinner with your family, where it's like lots of people who are mostly talking to themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
About, and like, it's like...
These mashed potatoes are so creamy.
Yeah. And like, people talking about like... You know, what? Like Gavin calls my family IMDB O'Donoghue. Because it'll just be like my dad being like, Dustin Hoffman, Dustin Hoffman is 5'8". And then like my brother being like, anyone see The Graduate? Da, da, da. And then someone would be like, oh, I saw The Graduate. But then actually,
it's like playing telephone and it goes around the table.
Yes, totally.
There's that thing, they say that like the number of conversations you can have in a room is the number of people divided by 5. Or something like that.
Okay.
And so, like, if you have, like, 7 or 8, you kind of have, like, 1.5 conversations going on at once. You're right. They really capture that sort of big, chaotic family dinner scene stuff in a way that, like, you mentioned The Family Stone. The family dinner scenes in The Family Stone are horrifying. They are so cringeworthy.
They're like Jordan Peele movies.
You're right. They are horror movies, that moment. And for some people, A Family Christmas is a horror movie. And for some people, it is a delightful comedy.
But it really gets at, and I'd never quite seen it quite so perfectly rendered, that thing of like, you see big family dinners in movies and it's like, you know, it's like something like The Family Stone, which feels like social horror drama, or you see like, oh, we're all just so rambunctious or whatever. We're flicking mashed potatoes with the spoon in it. But like, what you don't see as much is like just like ordinary people who are sort of dear, but a bit boring and a bit repetitive and a bit this, because that's what people are like when they're with their family, you know?
And there's one thing going on in lots of those other versions of this, and there are like eight things going on in these scenes, and they're all stupid.
They're all
like, Elsie made her eggnog, and we have feelings about eggnog, and they're like, there's all this stuff going on, and then on top of that, Sandra Bullock and Bill Pullman like making eyes at each other across the table, nodding at each other about how ridiculous it is.
Yeah.
And then there's just like a big you're right, it makes that mesh of different interpersonal relationships so well that makes it feel so cozy. It makes you want to be a part of it.
It is.
It makes you really want to go to that home for Christmas.
And it's this nice, very artful thing as well of like showing the audience that like that Sandy's character, she's not in it for the propaganda of big family.
Yes.
She's in it for the boring stuff and people being a bit weird and people being a bit inappropriate or repeating themselves or whatever. She's like, she just likes it. And
yeah, she just wants to hang out.
Yeah.
She just like, because she doesn't have anyone to, she says, I've never had anyone I can laugh with.
Oh.
She's so sad.
I do wish there was at least one sentence of her being like, all my friends are back in Milwaukee or something.
Just so
you know that she has had friends before.
You don't think she could make friends?
Yeah.
Well, she can't make friends with Celeste, that's true. Why doesn't she tell... Celeste invites her for New Year's. Why doesn't she tell Celeste that she's in this weird situation? I don't know.
I don't know.
Who knows?
Jerry knows.
We will never know.
He just doesn't retain any of the info.
That's very true.
I think that's it.
I feel like we've covered an unexpectedly large amount of ground.
It's been a real thrill ride.
A conversation about while he was sleeping.
I definitely feel like I'm going to rewatch this movie again.
Mm.
And I also feel like the multiplicity of the lenses that you can put on this movie.
Yes.
For such a real classic, something that they could have made in 1930 and it would have been broadly the same.
Mm.
You know, it's very, you know, it's very traditional in its outlook on love and family and Christmas. And yet I feel like it has all these lenses that are so applicable because it's so well made. And when something is well made, it's great art, has great utility, you know?
It's great to watch as an example of a rom-com. It's great to watch as a Christmas movie. It's great to watch as someone who just likes watching Sandra Bullock. It's great as a family movie. It's great as a movie about loneliness. And I don't know whether it lucked into a lot of those things or whether it is, as you say, just because it was so well-crafted.
Yeah.
And made by people who really wanted to make a great movie and succeeded. And that's so rare.
So rare.
I love it.
Me too. Sam Sedgman, do you want to plug some of your bits?
Oh, please do. I mean...
While
you were sleeping with Sam Sedgman. Oh my God. So as mentioned, I've written several novels for young readers. It's called the Adventures on Train series that I write with my very good friend MG Leonard. I've also written a non-fiction book for young readers, but really for anyone who likes trains, called Epic Adventures, about amazing railway journeys around the world. And depending on when you're listening to this episode, I have a new series of middle grade adventures launching on the 1st of February, 2024. It's called The Clockwork Conspiracy, and it's basically the Da Vinci Code for kids. It's about a kid who vanishes from the belfry of Big Ben on the night the clocks go back, and it's full of like secret codes and adventure and rooftop chases and all sorts of fun things. So if you like a children's book, or if you have any 8 to 12 year olds in your life and you're looking for a Christmas present or a birthday present, please do think of me.
Think of me.
Please buy my books. That's what I'm saying.
And hopefully, when that comes out, there's a great sort of like clock themed rom com you can come back.
Oh, absolutely. Great clock themed rom coms.
Might be just the Da Vinci Code.
I have a lot to say about the Da Vinci Code.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.